Welcome back. We are in this session finally getting out of Genesis. And you're going to have to change the patterns a little bit. You're used to me spending a few hours on a book, right? Because that's what we did with Genesis. But Genesis is so foundational. I tend to teach for 2 or 3 hours on Genesis. But we got to speed it up. Because if we do that for each book, we're only going to get about one-third the way through the Old Testament by the end of the course. So the plan is to have one session on Exodus, and then one on Leviticus, and then do it pretty much like that throughout. Maybe we'll have a couple on Isaiah or something like that, but I call this session Be Formed. Again, this is not in the Old Testament survey link. This is on Old Testament preaching, which is summing up what we've got in the survey course, right? I think Exodus is a good one to talk about as it relates to change. We see a lot of changes in Exodus, even as we saw it in Genesis. And we see a lot of change in our own day-to-day. I think a lot of us, depends how old you are maybe, some of us would like to see less changes. Others of us would like to see more changes. But one thing we do agree is that change is all around us. You cannot avoid change. Your family's changing. Your body's changing. Your church is changing. SBC is changing. You wouldn't believe how much SBC is changing. I mean, years ago, I used to be over here teaching. In this room, if you can imagine this room, 25 years ago. So I would stand about right here looking this way. It was cathedral style. That's what we call cathedral style. I would stand on the short end of the room and try to project all the way to Daniel there in the back, you know? And then people invented these projection machines. Because I used to use the overhead projector in this room, you know, back in the 90s. And then they started hanging them from the ceilings. And now this room's got two of them. And we turned the room around. And the air conditioners are on the ceiling instead of on the windows. And just think about this, just this room itself. It used to be so loud. You know, like that with the air conditioner. I've got to shout for a while the air conditioner's on. I go, is it cool enough for you guys? You know, yeah, okay, hit that air conditioner off. And the room would be cool, and then it'd get hotter and hotter as all this hot air started going around, mostly hot air from me. All right? And then get up a little bit louder. I said, you guys ready for a little bit of air conditioning? Yeah, hit the thing. You know, and I mean, life is just like that. There's so many changes. But I think God forms us through change. And if you're resistant to change, you're going to be resistant to God. Because He is the most current one in the universe. Despite people saying, oh, God doesn't, you know, he's not up to speed. God is the most relevant of all the universe, even though He's the oldest. But I wonder how many of our changes we actually credit to God. I wonder, if you think about how He is forming you, most of you are new students. You've been here just for 2 to 3 weeks. You've had a lot of forming. You've had a lot of adjusting to do in just the last few weeks. But have you asked, Lord, what are you actually trying to do in my life through all of this? That's really a great question to ask and answer. But I'm not going to ask the how. I'm going to ask the why question. This is a little deeper. Why is God actually forming us? We know that God's working in our lives, but why is He doing it? What's He actually trying to accomplish in our lives through all these changes that He brings our way? So in this study through Scripture, we left off in our last study with Israel in Egypt. They had all gone down there. And the wilderness wanderings had not started yet. They will start now in the book of Exodus. And what was our key word for Genesis? Election. Election. And I asked, how can we be faithful to God in a world of idols? And the answer is to live out God's choice of you and promises for blessing. You can be faithful by realizing that the Lord actually has elected you. And for what? He's actually elected you for blessing. Do I sound like a prosperity teacher? I am. I'm a prosperity gospel teacher plus. I'm not a prosperity gospel teacher, period. You know, everything's prosperity. I'm a prosperity gospel teacher where I do believe that any blessing and every blessing I have in my life really comes from the Lord. So I give credit to Him for that. I hope you do as well. But I'm a prosperity teacher plus. Plus, I also realize God uses change. God uses suffering. God uses difficulty. God uses even His discipline and judgment in our lives. So I don't think the prosperity teachers have it wrong. I think they have it incomplete. They're right that God does bless our lives. And I advise you, live for Jesus. Your life will be far more blessed than if you live for self. But also recognize that God does use difficulty in our lives. Anyway, so where are we now as we get to Exodus? Well, the last verses of Genesis says, so Joseph died at the age of 110. And after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. That should raise a question for us. What about God's promise of a land? If Joseph is buried in Egypt, why is he buried in Egypt? I thought God's plan was to give them the land of Canaan to Abraham's descendants. Well, it is, and God has not forgotten about his plan. So, thus we come to Exodus. All right? This is a book called Exodus because God is exiting the people, exiting out of Egypt. In fact, the word Exodus is a Greek word. I thought of that when my wife and I were visiting Corinth. A couple of years ago, we took a holiday. Can't remember what anniversary that was. You know, 30th, I think, something like that. Anyway, we went to Corinth and Athens. So we took a train from Athens over to Corinth. And we were looking for directions. How do you get out of this place? And then I looked up and I noticed above Susan, I noticed a sign. Exodus. it means way out. All right. In Singapore, we actually translate it, or we just say, you look for way out, the way out sign. That is literally what Exodus means. I could have looked at the English below it, but it was kind of fun looking at the Greek, you know? So the English title, Exodus, means a going out, or it's actually two Greek words put together. Ek, meaning out, and hados, meaning way. So it's way out. It means an exodus or departure. It doesn't take that long. They get out of Egypt by about chapter 12. And you know that Exodus goes all the way to Exodus 40. So it's not the major amount of the book, but it is definitely the most significant thing that happens in the book, where God is forming his people to bring them out of Egypt. Or I should say, God brings them out of Egypt to form them into the people he wants them to be. So that is our key word, formation. It's, kind of sounds like election, formation. You got the shun, you know, both times. Don't expect that for all the key words, all right? But we're going to start off that way. Now, they're not really a nation, though. They're just a family. They're a family of 70-something people. Then when they go into Egypt, and then they grow a lot. We see in Exodus 1, But are they a nation because they become bigger? They're not really a nation in the beginning of Exodus 1. But God has promised Abraham that he's going to make them into a nation. There's three things you really need to become a nation. This applies to Israel, but it applies to any country as well. You need freedom. So if you're under slavery, you're really not a nation. You're just a subgroup that's enslaved by another country. And so they're not a nation when they're in Egypt, but they are becoming a big, big family. They don't have their own form of government either. Government is necessary to be a nation, as I note on page 100 of your notes. And then thirdly, they need land. You cannot be a nation unless you have a place to live. Scattered people throughout the world are not a nation. Take the Chinese diaspora, for example. That's not a nation. That's just people who are ethnically Chinese that are scattered throughout the world. The nation they come from, China, is a nation, you know? So what Exodus does is it records the first two of these three needs. They get freedom and they get a government. They still don't have land, but that's going to come about in the book of Joshua. But they are beginning to be formed by God. I used to call this formation into a nation when I started teaching Exodus, and then I realized, nah, they're not really formed into a nation, but some major things are happening here. So I changed my theme for the book to formation into a nation begun. At least it started. In fact, more than started. Two out of the three requirements to become a nation occur in the book of Exodus. Chapters 1 to 18, we see them freed from slavery. Some have called it, and I agree with them, getting Israel out of Egypt. And that's all narration where it's focused on getting a free people. And then the rest of the chapters, 19 to 40, is they don't receive freedom from slavery. They receive law from God. And it's not getting Israel out of Egypt. It's getting Egypt out of Israel. In other words, they have adopted a lot of Egyptian ideas, and they need to realize that God has called them to be a different kind of nation than Egypt. They're not to be a replication of Egypt. They're to be God's holy people, single God, not all the gods of Egypt, for one. And this is all legislation with a little bit of narrative in it. You'll see chapter 32, the golden calf incident, is narrative. A couple other places, but it's mostly legislation. It's mostly instruction about how they get their government. So some would put it, I think I'll. You could do it this way, that you they get the Exodus in chapters 1 to 18. They get the law from 19 to 31, and then the tabernacle in the third section. So linking the law and the tabernacle together, and thinking of these in terms of two reasons that God forms us. So why does he do it? What would apply to both to Israel and to us? The first section of the book, the first 18 chapters, here's the principle. God saves us to show his power and care. I think this really is the point here. There's a salvation. There's a salvation from slavery here. And what does it demonstrate? God is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. Okay? And not only is he more powerful, but God cares. God loves his people. He has compassion on them. Over and over, this narrative says, and the Lord saw them, and he had compassion on his people to bring them out of their subjection. So God saved Israel from slavery in Egypt, and then he protected them in the wilderness. They actually get out of Egypt around chapter 12, but then we see the Lord just protecting and guiding them all the way up to chapter 18 before he gives them the law. What's the point? The point is God used Moses to urge Pharaoh to free Israel from slavery, to show that he cared, to show that he was faithful to the Abrahamic covenant, and he was sovereign over Egypt's gods. Kind of three ideas there. Makes me kind of wonder, what about Israel? They're under slavery for 400 years. That's a long time. You can forget who your God is and what he's promised you, right? I mean, some of us forget who God is in 400 minutes, 400 days, 400 weeks, whatever, you know. They have 400 years. And I wonder how many of them really were thinking about the Lord and how God had made this promise that they were going to live their existence in their own land. You know, I mean, how in touch are you with your ancestors 400 years ago? Any of you know the name of one of your ancestors 4 centuries ago? I know that my father's lineage goes all the way back to about 1650, believe it or not, in the United States. Part of the Puritans, you know, other waves of Puritans that came out of England. But do I know any of their names? No. That was about 400 years ago. And most of us are just not that in touch. They needed to be in touch with who their God really was, you know? Thus, we have this book written, and we have God doing all these wonderful things for them. So, it starts, the narrative starts there in Egypt with the Sphinx, the Great Pyramid, all these things, and we find that the Egyptians were ruthlessly oppressing Israel. It starts good, but Israel becomes too powerful, so they get enslaved. And they get enslaved by the superpower of the day. How in the world, of all places, are they going to be able to get out of Egypt? When you think Egypt, don't think of Egypt today. I keep asking my wife, sweetheart, do you want to go to Egypt? Let's go to the pyramids. Let's see. She's like, nah, I'm not so excited about really Egypt right now. It's just dirty and dusty. I said, but honey, this was the superpower. She says that was a long time ago, you know. You know, they were the most powerful nation in the world. And the question is really, were Egypt's gods more powerful than Yahweh? The Egyptians certainly thought so. Pharaoh thought so. Pharaoh himself claimed to be a god. They just go, no question. And so they initiate all their power. They require them to make bricks out of mud. And you know this story. They get the straw provided for them later on when Moses talks to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, no straw. You guys do the straw thing yourself too. You know, and this is very, very difficult times. But in the midst of it, you see people that are faithful. You see, the Hebrew midwives on the end of Exodus 1, they're supposed to throw the baby boys in the Nile, right? So what do the midwives say? Their excuse is, yeah, but the Hebrew women are not like those Egyptian women. They're a lot more vigorous. I thought, you ladies, that's not a good argument. Pharaoh's going to go, what do you mean insulting our women here in Egypt, you know? But he doesn't actually say that. He says, no, you're supposed to do this. And here we see an example in the midst of difficulty. These ladies say, we're not going to do this. Except maybe in the case of Moses. Moses gets born. I'm getting into chapter 2. And they obey Pharaoh. They throw him into the Nile. Right? Didn't they throw baby Moses into the Nile? They did. He had a little basket around him. But they probably took him. I want to ask them someday, did you guys just sort of toss it a little bit? You know? So the baby felt like he was rocking, you know? We did what Pharaoh said. He said, throw the babies in the Nile. And there's a wonderful story here because Miriam's here, Moses' older sister. And she says, she kind of comes out of the reeds, you know, would you like me to find someone to nurse this little baby boy? He's crying. Yeah? I'll bring him home to mom. Won't say that she's mom. But anyway, here's Moses' mother gets paid. by the king to nurse her own son. You know, my wife nursed our three sons. I don't think I ever paid her to do it, though. I guess I did. Provided meals and, you know, that kind of thing. Helped take care of her. And through all of this, Acts 7, when Stephen's commenting on this before his own death, he says, at that time Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months he was cared for in his father's house, and when placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took care of him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. There's Stephen's commentary. Moses, powerful in speech? Moses ends up taking things in his own hands, kills a man, his life is threatened, he ends up fleeing. So he goes from Goshen, he goes over to Midian. He even bypasses Mount Sinai. Now, somehow, actually, after he married Zipporah from Midian, they made their way up around over to Mount Sinai. Others would say Mount Sinai is over in this area of Midian today. I don't want to get in that debate. If you're curious about that, read the supplements to the Exodus notes. But there, in Exodus 3, God calls his servant. This is such a wonderful, wonderful story. Moses has committed, God has prepared him beautifully, wonderfully, to be able to know how to speak Egyptian and know Egyptian ways and all that stuff growing up in the palace. He's the perfect guy. But he messes up. And what does God do? Okay, I'm going to get someone else. Not at all. God goes and pursues him. God makes this bush not burn up. Now, I suspect Moses had seen other bushes burn before, but not one that actually doesn't burn up. And so he goes over there, and he says, hey, here's my opportunity to give God excuses. I'm kidding. He didn't really say it that way, you know. But he says, who am I to bring these people up out of Egypt? Now, God could have said, now, wait a second. I gave you private education right in the palace, and, you're considered to be a daughter of Pharaoh's, son of Pharaoh's daughter. You got all those privileges. Don't tell me who am I. God doesn't do all that. God doesn't say, he just says basically, you're asking the wrong question. Who am I? You should ask who God is, really. And he does. Who are you? Lord, who are you? I want to tell the people. If I'm going to tell them that God has sent me, well, which God is this? I mean, there's so many gods in Egypt, they're going to get confused. God says in Exodus 3:14, tell them, I am who I am has sent you. And here's the, really, God's claim to deity. Jesus uses this same phrase in John 8:58. When he declares himself to be the I am. If you see this in light of what is said here in Exodus 3:14, you understand that Jesus is actually declaring to be deity. Well, what if I fail? Is his excuse in chapter 4. And the Lord doesn't let him just keep giving these excuses, and God doesn't let him go. Does that sound familiar? Is that consistent with a God you know? When you've given him excuses? I know I've given him excuses. Lord, how can you use me? I mean, I remember being in class growing up. There were 24 kids in my class, and all 23 of them on Father Son night. You know, at school, they would all bring their fathers, but I was the only one without a father. So I brought my mother on father-son night. You know, my mom was so kind to come, but she was the only mother there. You know? Could God use this little kid who didn't have a father between the times my mother had married? And of course the answer is, yeah. He can use whoever he wants to. He can speak through a donkey if he wants to, but that's getting ahead of the story, you know? Moses protested in chapter 4, what if they won't believe me or listen to me? What if they say the Lord never appeared to you? And God says, take that rod in your hand and it'll become a snake and grab it by the tail. Just a little word to you guys. If you're ever going to grab a snake, don't grab him by the tail. Now, you probably don't want to grab a snake anyway, right? The few times that I've grabbed a snake, I was told, you know, grab him by the head. You grab him by the tail, they're going to turn around and bite you, you know? Everything that God seems to tell Moses to do is just so unlike us people, isn't it? Oh, I'm not gifted. I can't speak. Moses pleaded, oh, Lord, chapter 4, verse 10, I'm not very good with words. Never been. Not even now. Even though you've spoken to me. I get tongue-tied. My words get tangled. And God says, you just said that with perfect Hebrew. No, he didn't say that. But we know from Stephen, Moses was powerful in speech. And some of us say, I really can't talk. I had students in my preaching class say, I really can't talk in English. And I say, you just said that in English. If you said it in your language, I wouldn't have understood. You know, we can make all these excuses. And then, I don't want to be involved. Moses pleaded in verse 13. Oh, that's, I don't know where about you, but where I come from, 13 is the unlucky number, you know. Moses pleaded again, Lord, please, please send anyone else. Some people said, here I am, send Moses. I mean, here I am, send Aaron. No, you know. And then God says, here, this is really the key verse. God replied, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. It's really the, it's not based on who we are. When are we going to get that in our heads? This is about God. It's about God's work. This is God's plan. Well, in chapter 4, we see the conversation between Moses and Aaron and God ended up only after Aaron's appointment as a ministry partner. So Moses says, Lord, I want, you know, I can't do this. And God says, I actually knew you're going to say that, and so Aaron's been on his way to see you actually for a few weeks now, because he says, "What about your brother Aaron? I know he speaks well. He's on his way to meet you now." And then Aaron shows up. God knew all along all these difficulties. We really have three stages of Moses' life. 40 years as prince, where he's in Egypt. I call that the academic. Okay? Getting, I don't know how many languages he spoke. But he didn't speak sheep. So God wanted him to learn to speak sheep as well, right? You know? So he has 40 years as a shepherd. And this is his field ed. Field ed is very important. A lot of you are trying to get settled in your field ed right now, and you're going, oh, we really have to do this stuff? You know, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do 4 hours a week of field education? Just remember, Moses did 40 years in field ed. Literally, the field. You probably have air conditioning. They didn't have air conditioning for Moses. And then God, after 80 years, God says, okay, you're 80 years old, now I can use you. In 40 years, and Moses ended up dying at 120. He goes from Midian, goes to Egypt, and then he dies in the wilderness. We are often so hurried in such a rush. And I speak myself from about myself on this. I wanted to get going, get through, get my education, get. And I find that, you know, God doesn't go by my timetable. He's got his own, and his is actually best. The principle that I teach when I'm expounding this a little bit more in Exodus 3 and 4 is, God's servant who understands his own inadequacy will show God's sufficiency. It's not about your and my adequacy. It's about God's adequacy. It's about God's sufficiency. You want to hear God laugh? Use the word can't. And God's going to go, who can't? I can't? You can't, sure. But you can with me working through you. And you guys will be absolutely shocked to see what the Lord can do through you. My wife and I, when we're praying this morning, we're just reflecting back on the major events in our life. We never expected that God would do that through us. I mean, the major things, not just minor stuff. We never expected to come to Singapore and help start a school that our kids would graduate from 18 years later. You know, our son who was born here. I never expected to start a church here while I was on faculty at SBC. I said, no way do I have time to do that. This is way too demanding. I totally underestimated God. I never expected that I would ever have a website. I didn't even know what a website was when we came here. I mean, when I came on faculty, World Wide Web, that meant spiders throughout the world. You know, that's what World Wide Web meant. And now I realize that, you know, the Lord has allowed me to do these certain things that can help bring the gospel forward that I never dreamed. You're going to say the same thing. When you're approaching, I'm approaching 40 years in ministry now. Next year is our 40th year in full-time ministry. You'll say the same thing when you look back on a few decades of ministry. Because you have the same God, same faithful God. So, God calls Moses to go back. And sure enough, the rod does turn into a snake. He gains a little credibility there, but Pharaoh's magicians end up doing the same thing. And in the various plagues, there's these 10 plagues that go all the way up to chapter 12. It goes on and on. God, here's the key point of the plagues. God himself was bigger than Egypt's gods. Each one of these plagues is actually a slap in the face, you might say, of one of the gods of Israel, I mean of Egypt, and how the one God of Moses is greater than every one of these other gods. And so that brings us into Israel actually being able to get out of Egypt in chapter 12. Now, I think the point of chapters 12 to 18 is that God redeemed Israel from Egypt and protected them in the desert, to show his sovereignty, his ability, and his care for the nation until she had her own land. I mean, a lot of good what it would be for the Lord to bring them out of Egypt and then they all die in the wilderness. That is what they're fearful of, you know. And what God was actually trying to do is he was trying to say, I am bigger than all of those Egyptian gods. I can take care of you. I am able. Could any God keep 2 million people out in the desert for 4 decades? Could any God do that? Any Egyptian God? Could the God of rain do that? They don't have. Where are they going to get water? Where are they going to get food? We're talking about 2 million people or more. God could and God did. And the meaning of the plagues is actually seen in Exodus 12:12. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. And it's really the same thing for you and me. I mean, he's the God of God, Lord of all lords, but we have all these other little gods that we rely on. Numbers, recalling the Exodus significance, says, the Israelites set out from Ramses on the 15th day of the first month, the day after the Passover, and they marched out boldly in full view of all the Egyptians who were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, for the Lord had brought judgment on their gods. There's the point. And we don't have the time to go into Hapi, the god of the spirit of the Nile, and the Hek, the god of frogs, and Set, the god of mosquitoes, etc., etc. But each one of these 10 plagues is God's very overt way of saying, I'm bigger than all the Egyptian gods. Don't cling to any of the Egyptian gods. So they go out of Goshen. They cross what the Hebrew text says is Yam Suf. And Yam Suf literally means Sea of Reeds. But it was erroneously translated as Red Sea when the Old Testament was translated in Greek in the LXX. So they actually put it a little bit farther too far south. I'm not denying the miracle here. I'm just saying I think we've got confusion here in terms of where it actually took place. And it was a time where you have to be really, really prepared to trust the Lord and not have a backup plan, you know? And the Exodus, it really took faith to walk through that sea. You have to give credit to Moses. He went through, but the people went through with him. They did what we would call, and I'll elaborate on this more later, seemingly stupid things. I mean, if the sea opens up, you know it's going to close back in. So, I mean, it really takes faith to go on into that sea. And the Exodus actually is the most significant event in Israel's history. Even to today, the most significant holiday, Passover, looks back at Exodus. It's significant because it's a reminder that God is more powerful than Egypt's gods or any gods anywhere the people of Israel live. It's significant because God fulfilled his promise actually to the very day to bring the people out of Egypt. This point's often not made, but if you go to Exodus 12, verse 40, it gives the timing when the people came out of Egypt. It says, the people of Egypt had lived in Egypt, the people of Israel had lived in Egypt for 430 years. In fact, it was on the last day of the 430th year that all the Lord's forces left the land. Amazing, isn't it? God told Abraham, your descendants will be brought away 400 years in a land that's not their own. Is that sort of a round number? You know, kind of like 400 years, you know. God says, no, it's on the very day. Count those 400 years. This one says 430 years. There's some chronological issues here that we don't have the time for, but God's saying this took place exactly to the day 400 years later. Makes me wonder how many things that God does that's exactly on time and I just totally miss it. Just kind of goes over my head, you know? And the whole typology of the Passover lamb comes about through this Exodus experience because they sacrificed the Passover lamb that very night that they leave. And it's actually, God actually begins a second calendar. They had followed a civil calendar up to this point, but God actually begins a second calendar, which is often called the spiritual, the sacred calendar that night. Because Exodus 12 says, while the Israelites were still in the land of Egypt, the Lord gave the following instructions to Moses and Aaron. From now on, this month will be the first month of the year for you. The month of Nisan ends up becoming the first month. So throughout the years, Israel actually has two or more calendars. You guys understand about that because you operate on more than one calendar as well. You have an academic calendar that begins in July. So this is the first month, right? But we all know this is the seventh month of the year. You have a personal calendar because I doubt that all of you were born in July, right? My personal calendar is consistent with the solar calendar because my birthday is in January. But most of us, we operate on, you know, three or more calendars. And so this is the beginning of the nation, actually, here. God says he's beginning to form his own people. He gives them a new calendar. And then he tells them Pesach, the Passover meal, is actually looking back to this particular event. All right? He brings them in chapter 16. They don't have food. He gives them bread from heaven. They go, what is it? They go, oh, that's a good name for it. What is it? Mana means what is it? So every time they're eating something, hey, what is it? What is it? But what is it? What is it? You know? The answer is the same as the question. You know? And do they need light? Well, they're out there. There's no street lights, you know, out there. God provides his own street light. You know, this huge fire, pillar of fire, gives them light so that they can find the way to the toilet at night. You know, and whatever else they need to do at night, you know, cooking and all that. He opens the sea for them. All these things are brought out in 1 Corinthians 10, where God says they all went through the sea. They all were under the cloud. They all ate the bread from God. They all followed Moses. And God gave them food from heaven. This is all the background to what Paul's saying in 1 Corinthians 10. In other words, we are a community, a covenant community as a church. We see that same thing back in the Old Testament. He provides them water. He gives them wisdom. Anyway, so many things that he brings them down to Mount Sinai. And we can have some understanding of this now because we realize that Jesus is our new Exodus, who delivers us from sin. Jesus is our Passover lamb. You see this in 1 Corinthians 5, 7. It says, for Christ is our Passover lamb. We have no understanding what that really means apart from reading this. And this shows his power and care. And Jesus did this same thing. He explained that really what the Old Testament was doing in Luke 24 was talking about himself. John the Baptist could see this because he saw the similarity between a little lamb and Jesus. Most of us, well, that would certainly escape me. I'd go, there's similarity between that little lamb and Jesus, a one-year-old lamb? I don't get it. John would say, this lamb is innocent. This one-year-old lamb that you use for Passover, Jesus is also innocent. And they both are pictures of redemption. In fact, they had to do what was seemingly quite silly. Put the blood on the top and the sides of their door. And God said, that's going to save your life tonight of your firstborn son. Now, I don't have to worry about that because I'm not the firstborn, right? I have an older brother. But I don't want my brother to die. You know? But think about it. God tells you, you do this. The firstborn son's going to, he's not going to die. I mean, you look at that humanly, the skeptics among us will be very vocal and say, that's ridiculous. That's going to save my brother's life? Seriously? A little blood on the door? God was asking him to do something humanly that seems really stupid. As stupid as, let me place my faith in a man who lived 2,000 years ago and reorient my entire life based on a man who lived 2,000 years ago from the standpoint of, well, frankly, my family. A lot of people in my family. They think my wife and I are nuts. You guys spent 30 years as missionaries? What? For this myth? That's how they look at it. And that's how some people look at you too. Don't you think? But you have a long line of people who have gone before you, all the way back to Egypt and all the way back before that. But Hebrews 11 comments back on this and says, by faith he kept the Passover, Moses, and sprinkled the blood so the destroyer of the firstborn wouldn't touch the firstborn of Israel. Did you notice that the blood, when it drips on down, is where the blood is on the door, it's actually on three parts, exactly where the cross is. I'd like to find out someday when I talk to the Lord about this. Is that what you meant? Did you want to do that? He says, Jesus is our Passover lamb, you know? So it's faith in a lamb, which seems silly. About as silly from a secular standpoint as Jesus saying, this is my body. Most will go, no, it's not. You're standing right there. That's not your body. You're holding bread, you know? I mean, honestly, I'm trying to just look at this how other people might look at it. But the angel of death passed over those houses. And the common thread here, what the Exodus is to the Old Testament, the cross of Christ is to the New Testament. And that common thread between the two is deliverance. As Israel was delivered out of Egypt, their slavery, so Jesus delivers us out of our own slavery to sin. Colossians 1:13 says this quite well. Colossians 1:13 says, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Isn't that amazing? And this is something we all share by faith, as 1 Corinthians 10 was saying. All of them had all these blessings, the cloud, the food, the water, etc. And so to answer this question, why is God forming us? We've seen in the first 18 chapters, God saves us to show his power and his care. He wants us to know that he really loves us. And he did that for Egypt, and he does it for us. But I also would say that another reason why God is forming us is because God teaches us as his new people to enjoy his presence. He's forming us to realize that he's actually with us. This is the emphasis of the latter part of Exodus. God's presence with his people. They need to be taught about that in these last, in this last section. So as God saved Israel from slavery in Egypt and protected them in the first 19 chapters, we see that God taught Israel the Mosaic law so he could live with them in the tabernacle. They were actually making not a place to go and worship God, a tabernacle. Oh, well, let's go to the tabernacle to go worship God who lives somewhere else. The word tabernacle also means palace. Do you know that? They were actually, in the latter part of Exodus, making God's palace, mobile palace, if you will, that they could carry up on their shoulders. And God's palace would go with them wherever they were going. So God gave the law to start Israel's covenant relationship with God, with a holy God. And why was the law so important? Because the law gave a governmental charter. The constitution that you have and that forms your country is absolutely important. It provides a framework for your country. And you should know it. Same idea with Israel there in Exodus 19, where Moses became the covenant mediator between God and his people. And he says something quite amazing here in this chapter, Exodus 19, 5 and 6. Now, if you obey me fully, notice the if, okay, and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you'll be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. God is inviting them. Hey, do you remember back on this ruling thing that Adam and Eve had, where they were able to rule with God? I'm inviting you into this kingdom as well. Kingdom of priests in this sense. So my summary statement for Exodus goes like this. Israel's formation as a nation begins under God as king. He's invited to be the king by a miraculous redemption from Egypt and a revelation of the Mosaic Law. There's the first part and the second part. To provide a kingdom over which a descendant of Judah could rule and promote holiness and trust in God. So we see God giving the Big Ten. You're familiar with the Ten Commandments, but the Ten Commandments fit right in this as a really the introduction to what we find in the law. And the heart of the Mosaic Covenant is the Ten Commandments. What God is actually doing here is he's forming this nation. And I would say, page 116, contrast the Abrahamic covenant we've talked about a little bit with the Mosaic covenant that's coming now. The blessings of the Abrahamic covenant are universal, but the blessings of the Mosaic covenant, you find other places in the Old Testament that says that only Israel received the law. This law given through Moses to the nation of Israel was not given to any other country, any other nation. And in that sense, it's very unique. It's also different from the Abrahamic covenant, which is more unconditional, where God says to Abraham, I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. This one we have, if you'll do this, then I'll do this. If you'll do this, then I'll do this. We'll talk about this more in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. This is written on tablets of stone, and it's written on the Pentateuch. You don't find that of the Abrahamic covenant. This is typified in the tabernacle, whereas the Abrahamic covenant is typified in Jesus as the ultimate seed. Those are some of the differences between these two. Knowing the distinction between these two covenants is very important in understanding the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testament, for that matter. But they need a place for God to dwell. So the tabernacle, along with the Ark of the Covenant, is built while they're there. The brazen altar, the laver to wash their hands and feet, the lampstand to provide light, table of showbread, bread for the priests, the altar of incense, which ends up becoming really a symbol of prayer as incense goes on up. And it's an amazing structure that they are building out here. And many have said that the tabernacle actually prefigures the cross. Even the form of it, even the design of it, where you go through the brazen altar first, offer your sacrifice, and then move on up to the priest would wash their hands, and then they would go in. Right and left would be the candlestick. It almost looks like a cross. And the head of where the cross, where Jesus would actually be where the Ark of the Covenant was. But the bigger point here is that the tabernacle is God being set up to be the king there. The priesthood is all designed here, including the high priest, the Urim and the Thummim, and people are still trying to figure out what all that's about. But the bottom line here is that Israel built the tabernacle where God dwelt as king. They were inviting him to come to be king by building the tabernacle. They had quite a setback by worshiping this golden calf, you know, that Aaron threw in the fire and whoop, popped out the calf. Hi, you know, that's what Aaron says. We threw this in the fire and then out popped this calf. Like he's believed Moses, thought Moses would believe that, you know. Moses is so angry, he smashes the tablets, and God says, okay, you're going to chisel out the next ones yourself, you know? Little discipline there, but God writes on the next one. And finally, Exodus 40, we see the tabernacle. God's saying, once it's all built, the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. The point? God's presence filled his new palace. God was pleased. And in like manner, Jesus brings us into a new covenant where he indwells us with his Spirit. So the similarities to what he's really doing with us is quite amazing. He ends up indwelling Solomon's temple later on, but that same Spirit comes upon the church at Pentecost. And the indwelling Spirit is right inside every one of us. To the shock of people who don't understand, really, God's very Spirit is indwelling you? Indeed, He is. So why is God forming us? To save us, to show His power and care, and to teach us as His new people to enjoy His presence. Or the main idea I think of Exodus is God saved you to enjoy His presence, because His presence indwells you. So what are you supposed to be doing about it? Well, it's Jesus. It's about Jesus over religion. Jesus is your compassionate high priest. Jesus wants relationship with you, not rituals. I believe in spiritual disciplines, but spiritual disciplines is no replacement for really having a relationship with Jesus. I think you would agree with me on that point.